the thicker pools of oil, we've been able to find those. Now the stuff we're looking for is challenging. It's more challenging to find that oil these days. But we believe it's there.
Oil companies make the case for lower state taxes. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 16th of February. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a new plant that has Alaskan farmers excited.
It's phenomenal because people are looking for things to grow here that actually make money.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ANSEP, the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, where every year Alaska Natives from all corners of the state graduate and become engineers, scientists, and physicians. Students can get involved as early as middle school, then move to the University of Alaska Anchorage, Fairbanks, or Southeast in a program based on skill building, collaboration, and community. Learn more at ANSEP.net. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program.
Despite sober warnings by President Obama that federal spending must be reined in, he actually wants to boost funding for the Energy Department. The new budget blueprint would give it more than $29 billion, nearly a 12% increase from current appropriation levels. But it would eliminate subsidies to oil companies and dramatically cut the budget for fossil fuel energy by 45%. That's not sitting well with Alaska's congressional delegation, which fears it will hurt the oil and gas industry. Today, Energy Secretary Stephen Chu testified before the Senate Energy Committee, where Lisa Murkowski is the top Republican. Chu talked about the president's goal of having 80% of America's electricity coming from clean energy by 2035. That includes natural gas and hydropower. Good news for Alaska. But Murkowski pointed out that other forms of energy are getting more financial support.
Wind is getting a 60% plus up. Solar, almost 88%. Increase. Biomass is at about a 57% plus up. Geothermal, 135%. Massive budget increases in terms of their categories. But you look to some of the others, hydropower, which is one that we pay particular attention to in Alaska, cut by 20%. Nuclear power decreases slightly at 0.6%. Nuclear waste is not addressed. All funding for natural gas technologies are zeroed out.
Secretary Chu responded that natural gas and hydropower are part of the clean energy standard the White House wants to pursue, but he says fossil fuels are considered mature technologies and received plenty of money in decades past. He says the real need for funding is in renewables like solar and wind that are cutting edge.
Quite frankly, it's a world race in order to get to those improvements. Whether it's going to be by the end of this decade or perhaps a few years further, there's a significant chance that solar energy will be competitive without any subsidy with fossil fuel. The country or the companies that develop that technology will have a worldwide market. And so we see these as putting investments in the new technologies that we think ultimately will be the technologies of the future.
The budget laid out by Secretary Chu is just a proposal and will be hashed out by Congress in the coming weeks. After today's committee meeting, Senator Murkowski journeyed to the White House to talk with President Obama. Her spokesman says the senator asked to meet with the president on, quote, a range of Alaskan issues. He would not be more specific and would not say what the senator's reaction was. Murkowski is seen as a senator the White House wants to court on energy issues. The Senate Indian Affairs Committee met today for the first time this year in a short session to officially get the new Congress underway. Hawaii Senator Daniel Akaka took the gavel as chairman, and Wyoming Senator John Barrasso is the top Republican. Alaskan Senator Lisa Murkowski held on to her committee seat. But one voice is noticeably absent, that of recently retired Senator Byron Dorgan of North Dakota. As APRN's Libby Casey reports, Dorgan led the committee through one of Congress's most significant eras of progress on Native issues.
Former Senator Byron Dorgan says listening is the key to progress.
The only way it works to get things done is if you reach out and work with those who are running the tribal governments around the country, and also with the tribal members to sit and talk with them, hold listening sessions all across the country, which we have done. And then from that, develop the approaches that all of us believe can work.
That may sound obvious, but Dorgan says it hadn't really been done. So he made visiting Indian country a big part of the committee's agenda. And that was a shift to Alaska Natives and Native Americans who, for so long, were flat out ignored by Washington. Dorgan sat down with APRN in December as his time as chairman was wrapping up and reflected on his final years in the Senate.
We have probably done more and more significant policy pieces on legislation in this Congress than have been done in 30 years in the Congress. I mean, it's pretty amazing because this is seen as a Congress in which it's hard to get things done.
Major bills signed into law include the Indian Health Care Improvement Act and the Tribal Law and Order Act, the longstanding Cobell settlement over the government's mismanagement of Indian trusts was finally wrapped up, and the stimulus bill sent $2.5 billion to Indian country. Dorgan says getting attention for Alaska Native and American Indian issues hasn't been easy, despite some shocking statistics.
You know, when you have, for example, in a healthcare situation, you have Native Americans, those who were here first and greeted everybody that came to this great country, when you have 40% of their healthcare needs unmet, there is full-scale healthcare rationing going on. That ought to be a scandal on the front page headlines of every newspaper in the country, but it's not, because those winds of scandal blow on Indian reservations all across the country every single day, so it's not a news item.
One of the ways Dorgan combated the apathy and busy schedules of other lawmakers was to personalize the issues.
Rather than just say, you've got to keep your promise for health care for American Indians, I decided I'm going to make sure all of my colleagues stare in the face of a young child or stare in the face of an elder.
That's what made Dorgan care. He remembers going to the Crow Reservation in Montana and meeting a grandmother who held up a picture of a little girl who was sick but was repeatedly misdiagnosed because of poor medical care at an Indian Health Service clinic. The child died of cancer. Dorgan made it his mission to share her story.
And I took the picture of Tashawn Rain Littlelight, and she was a little dancer, and she was in her traditional dress, beautiful picture with sparkling bright eyes. And I held that up on the floor of the Senate on an easel every time I spoke about this, so that my colleagues would understand this is not some abstraction. This is about kids who are dying.
That personal touch is what helped Senator Dorgan win supporters, says Jacqueline Johnson-Peta, an Alaskan who is executive director of the nation's largest Native organization, the National Congress of American Indians.
I think he did it better than anybody I've ever seen do it before. He'll tell the story of someone at home in North Dakota or the challenge of suicides in Indian communities. We can all talk about them, but when he talked about that teenager or he talked about that feeling of hopelessness, he painted the picture and made it come alive.
After nearly three decades in Congress, Dorgan now hopes to use those techniques off Capitol Hill. He's working part-time for a D.C. law firm, teaching at Georgetown University, and he founded the Center for Native American Youth, which is launching this month through the Aspen Institute. Dorgan says one of its goals is combating the crisis of suicide.
Of all the things that I have done that, number one, has broken my heart in some ways and others given me great inspiration in other ways, is the issue of Indian children, what they confront on a daily basis in some areas of the country, and what needs to be done to give them the same hope that the rest of us have in this country, that you can become what you want to become and have a life that is a life full of opportunity.
Dorgan says because of that, his work fighting for Alaska Natives and Native Americans will continue. And he says along the way, he hopes to be part of a new chapter in history, one that restores trust with Indian country. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
About a dozen crewmen and contractors are working to clean up a fuel spill that occurred in Unalaska yesterday. The Aleutian Lady was moored at the dock when the spill occurred. Approximately 800 gallons of diesel fuel spilled into the bay. Petty Officer First Class Jason Munoz is overseeing the cleanup.
The starboard tank was overfilled. The fuel went through the vent into a containment area on the vessel. That overfilled into the next space and then out through the deck drain.
No hydraulic oil or lube leaked into the bay. The Coast Guard conducted an assessment of the damage. A shoreline cleanup was conducted yesterday. Workers continued to contain and remove the fuel today. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, you've heard of Steller's sea lions, but what about Steller's curse?
The Westerner's reaction wasn't, oh wow, these are really magnificent animals. That was like, oh wow, let's go kill them and get their fur or their feathers or their blubber.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
Representatives of the oil industry were at the state capitol today to offer general support for Governor Sean Parnell's bill reducing their taxes in an attempt to increase production on the North Slope. With a recognition that oil production is declining and will continue to decline over the years, ConocoPhillips Vice President for External Affairs Wendy King said that Alaska still has very high possibilities for finding and producing more oil, but she says there are problems to overcome.
The challenge we face as an industry is that the costs are higher these days to produce a barrel of oil. The technology requirements are greater. The reservoirs are more complex these days. The bigger sands, the thicker pools of oil, we've been able to find those. Now the stuff we're looking for is challenging. It's more challenging to find that oil these days. But we believe it's there.
King told the House Resources Committee that a lot of factors come into play when her company is deciding to invest in a project, and the biggest concern is uncertainty in the return on their investment. In considering the risk versus rewards of an investment, she says the state's progressivity surtax on profits from high oil prices takes away from the reward side of the equation.
Where we see the biggest challenge with the ACES tax structure is the progressivity piece. And where that really affects us is when oil prices are high, particularly in an oil province like Alaska, that's when companies are generating a significant cash flow opportunity by where they can reinvest. But now with the progressivity so steep, what you're seeing is rather than that coming back for the parties to be able to reinvest in, it's being paid out in taxes.
Governor Parnell's proposed changes to the state's tax regime would effectively lower the progressivity feature by an estimated $1 billion in state revenue per year. Governor Sean Parnell has until Friday to decide whether to accept a $1 million federal grant to help set up a state-run health insurance exchange that would give Alaskans and small businesses access to competitive information they can use to develop health insurance coverage. Seven Democratic members of the Senate majority today wrote the governor, urging him to accept the federal money. In their letter, they reminded him of the alternative. If there is no state system in place, a federal information exchange will be established for Alaskans to use. Anchorage's Johnny Ellis was one of the letter's signers. He says Alaska is the only state that hasn't started setting up an exchange, even among states that have challenged the overall Federal Affordable Care Act.
Even if Governor Parnell and the other governors who are suing over health care reform and the individual mandate win at the Supreme Court, regardless of which way it goes, the health exchanges are still a good idea for everyone. And every other governor has recognized that, and we just want to work with our governor here in Alaska to convince him that the right thing for Alaskan citizens, regardless of their political philosophy, is to move on with the exchanges.
Ellis says establishing a way for the public to compare health insurance policies was designed to encourage competition, calling it one part of the federal law that is market-driven. No legislation would be needed to accept the money or to set up the exchange. A hardy wild herb that grows well in the Arctic could become the next big cash crop for Alaska. Farmers are learning more about Rhodiola rosea at the Alaska Growers Produce Conference in Palmer this week. The high-value medicinal plant is used to make a supplement aimed at reducing stress and increasing productivity. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
Dr. Petra Illig doesn't have a background in horticulture or agriculture. She doesn't even claim to have a green thumb, but her front yard is now covered in Rhodiola rosea.
My neighbors are, you know, hoping this is all legal, and I keep assuring them it is.
Illig is a physician in Anchorage, but she doesn't dabble in natural medicine. She first got interested in the plant after reading about it in a science magazine. She says the plant is used for stress management, to relieve depression, and to help cosmonauts increase their performance.
And I thought, wow, here is an Arctic plant that has a potential high world market. Why don't we try to grow this?
Over the last 2 years, Illig has grown over 90,000 seedlings. Illig says most Rhodiola rosea currently on the market comes from wild plants in Siberia, but she says demand for the plant is far outstripping that limited supply. Farmers in Alberta, Canada, have started growing Rhodiola rosea, and Illig wants Alaskans to be the next in line.
It's phenomenal because people are looking for things to grow here that actually make money. And this is something that can be done on a small scale, a backyard farmer, all the way to a large acreage farmer. And my fantasy is even in villages. I mean, you know where this would be a beautiful place to grow? It's Nome and Kotzebue.
Illig is already helping several farmers around the state get started. Farmers in Bethel, Trapper Creek, Delta Junction, and the Matsu Valley are growing it. But Rhodiola rosea does require a significant time investment. It takes about 5 years to become mature enough to harvest. Still, the organizer of this year's Produce Growers Conference thinks it has great potential. Steve Brown says he hears a lot of far-fetched ideas for crops in Alaska. And when Illig first approached him, he was sure that's exactly what he was in for.
And I kind of rolled my eyes like, oh, you know, another miracle plant. But then as I read it, I realized she had really done her research and had, you know, research information from other countries to back this up. So I thought, boy, this really deserves a second look, and indeed it did.
Brown has worked as a university cooperative extension agent for 2 decades, and he says he's never seen farmers more excited about a new potential crop. Illig founded a nonprofit farmers co-op called Alaska Rhodiola Products to help get them started. She expects the first significant harvest in the state in 4 to 5 years. And by that time, Illig wants to have a processing plant up and running in Alaska.
Because it doesn't make sense to send tons and tons and tons of roots to the lower 48 to be processed. They'll get, you know, the quality of the product will be rapidly diminished if it has to be transported a long way.
That extract could be sold to companies that make rhodiola pills and teas. But Illig's dream is to eventually have an Alaskan-made product line to sell to rhodiola enthusiasts around the world. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Begin your UAF fisheries degree at any major University of Alaska campus and finish in Fairbanks or Juneau. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2011 PFD. Paper applications are available at the same 270 statewide locations as last year. More information at alaska.pfd.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Rookie Dallas Seavey won the Yukon Quest last night. The 23-year-old Willow Musher is the youngest person to win the quest. Seavey crossed under the finish banner on the Chena River in downtown Fairbanks at 11.05 p.m. with 10 dogs to claim the $28,000 first prize. KUAC's Emily Schwing has the story.
Dallas Seavey is the 2011 Yukon Quest champion. He's also this year's Rookie of the Year. At the finish line, CV said he never anticipated running a winning race.
It's a lot of fun camping with dogs. That was my goal when I came here, is to have a good time and just, you know, not be stressed out running dogs like oftentimes we are on the Iditarod. It's kind of a secondary race. I was going to have a good time, and hey, things turned out pretty well.
He comes from a long line of mushers. His grandfather helped found the Iditarod. But Dallas is the first CV to run the Yukon Quest.
You know, I'm a rookie here. I didn't know what to expect, so I just came ready to run my dogs.
This year's race has been a dramatic one. A fast-paced run through Canada gave way to blizzards, windstorms, and severe overflow in Alaska. But Seavey said his rookie status is only applicable to the trail itself and not the conditions.
The weather, it's cold, it's warm, it was wet. You know, we had everything. It was windy. But it's nothing I hadn't seen before. It's just I hadn't seen it here.
Sebastian Schnula came across the finish line in second place shortly after Seavey. He won the race in 2009 and finished in the top 10 in four previous races.
This was for sure the ugliest, coldest one, you know. I think there will be some long-term memory on this. I don't know, positive or negative, I don't know yet.
In past years, Schnula threatened to retire from the Yukon Quest. When asked if he'd return again next year, he didn't say no, but he didn't say yes either.
Well, I stopped saying never, so you never know.
Ken Anderson, the third musher to cross the finish line, said he was relieved he'd finally made it to his hometown, Fairbanks, where he was looking forward to sleeping in his own bed.
I'm so ready to be done.
This is a rough race.
This is just a crazy race. I mean, it was actually kind of fun to, like, be a spectator from within, you know? I mean, I just kept getting surprised myself around every corner, you know?
Anderson is also the winner of the Dawson Gold. Hugh Neffs was the first and fastest team into Dawson. However, the rules state that the winner of the Dawson Gold is not only the fastest into Dawson, but also a race finisher. Neff was withdrawn from the race after a windstorm halted his attempt to cross Eagle Summit.
That's going to be real nice. Coming in here, I started to think about that. Like, I wonder what happens. You know, it's, yeah, nice bonus.
This year's prize purse is roughly $150,000. The top 15 finishers win prize money. With only 14 teams left in this year's race, everyone will take something home. Reporting on the Yukon Quest Trail in Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
The name Stellar comes up a lot in Alaska. There are Stellar sea lions, Stellar's eiders, and of course, Stellar's jays. But just who was explorer George Stellar, and what is his legacy in the state? Russ Andrews, a biologist at the Alaska Sea Life Center, has been studying those questions. And as for the legacy, he says it could be more accurately described as a curse.
The animals that, of course, he described got written up. People learned about them, and many of them are really magnificent animals. But unfortunately, the Westerners' reaction wasn't, oh, wow, these are really magnificent animals. That was like, oh, wow, let's go kill them and get their fur or their feathers or their blubber. And that led to the extirpation of things like the sea cow. Sea cows were already hunted all throughout the range, and they were left just on this one island, Bering Island, which is where, at the end of Bering's second voyage, they shipwrecked. Bering ended up dying there, but Stellar got to spend 9 months there observing the wildlife, and he wrote up the only scientific description of the Stellar sea cow. And he also described northern fur seals, sea otters, Stellar sea lions. All of those animals were subsequently hunted and have had other issues.
Do you think some of Stellar's animals are still suffering the after effects of exploitation today?
Well, probably not that original early exploitation, other than the fact that some of them are now extinct. The fur seals, for example, their populations were driven to really low numbers. But then once they were protected in the early 1900s, their population started to increase and looked like they should have been just fine. But now, in the last 15 years or so on the Pribilof Islands, their populations are going down again for unexplained reasons. And so that's some of my own research, and what I'll talk about in the lecture I give tonight at the Campbell Creek Science Center is trying to understand why fur seals are declining now. We really don't know. Same thing with Stellar sea lions. Stellar sea lion populations, they weren't very tasty. Stellar didn't like to eat them, even though they were right there on the Bering Island, and they were shipwrecked there for so long. But they didn't have very good fur, and they're not very tasty. So they weren't actually exploited for much. But why they declined over the last 30 years is also a bit of a mystery. You know, there's certainly no single cause. It was probably a combination of factors.
Have any of the animals Stellar described managed to escape the curse?
Well, of course, everybody knows about Stellar's jay, But even that animal is cursed because Stellar is this guy whose name is spelled S-T-L-L-E-R. Quite often, Stellar's Jay, there's a street, Stellar's Jay Lane, halfway to Seward from here, that intersects with the Seward Highway. That sign comes right to the Seward Highway, and it's misspelled. It has an A at the end, like it was some kind of a starlight kind of Jay. But so even though Stellar's Jay is quite plentiful, their name is quite often misspelled, so maybe they're even cursed.
So why is it, do you think that more people don't know more about this man?
Well, right after the end of the voyage, some of Stellar's writings did make it back to St. Petersburg, but the Russians were really keen to keep all this secret. You know, they wanted all these furs, sea otter pelts, and fur seals for themselves. And also the navigation maps that were made, they wanted to keep that all secret. So most of Stellar's writings were buried. Very few people got to see anything from this. And fortunately, a few things were discovered recently in some of the archives in St. Petersburg. So hopefully we'll learn more. But a lot of it was just completely buried. And because he died himself, he wasn't able to publish any of his work. So what we do have of his writings were later posthumously published by people that thought, hey, you know, people really deserve to see this. But unfortunately, that's very little of what he actually probably wrote.
Got a little bit of a international espionage feel to the whole thing.
Yeah,
hiding
yeah,
his
exactly, which is part of what I'll relay in my story tonight. Going back to work in Russia sometimes can be really difficult. I've been on a lot of interesting voyages with rusty ships that I thought were about to crash. Nothing as terrible as what Stellar and Bering had to live through, but even got into some of my own little espionage thing. This past summer, you might have heard about these 10 Russian spies that were arrested in the United States, these sleeper cell of 10 Russian spies. One of them was this sexy redhead that was in the news for a while last summer. Well, 2 days after that happened, a big Russian naval ship came up to our research vessel, and we were doing some stellar sealing work on Menyao, and this vessel came on board our ship and immediately said, show us your telemetry devices. One of the things I do is to design telemetry devices to track the underwater movements and the behavior of the animals that I study, like fur seals and sea lions. And how they knew that we even had telemetry devices was a mystery, but it turned out they had been keeping really close eye on us, that just to use American-made telemetry devices over, they have lots of different kinds of permissions. We're right on the border with the U.S. and Russian. The Russians are still very sensitive about these things. So when these Russian spies were arrested in the United States, the Russians needed their own spy to grab a hold of in case they needed to do a little spy swap, and somehow we ended up near the top of their list.
Russ Andrews is speaking tonight at 7 p.m. at the Campbell Creek Science Center in Anchorage. His talk is titled Stellar's Curse, The Unfortunate Fate of Alaska's First Naturalist and the Marine Mammals That Bear His Name. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at aprn. We had reports tonight from Alexandra Gutierrez in Unalaska, Emily Schwing on the Yukon Quest Trail, and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Kristen Spack. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Doyon Limited, based in Alaska's interior, growing across the nation. ANSEP, the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, where every year Alaska Natives from all corners of the state graduate and become engineers, scientists, and physicians. Students can get involved as early as middle school, then move to the University of Alaska Anchorage, Fairbanks, or Southeast in a program based on skill building, collaboration, and community. Learn more at ANSEP.net. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program.
And by
AT&T, rethink possible. Details at att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
Aspatka nasuf kunun notung chluten Indian Trust landa mak IIM accounta mak bink chluten, hwaslo gingu vakluten Indian Trust agun, nun notung chlum hwasla accounta mak bink chlum. Biugovit aging you mountain Ilinik $3.4 billion settlementam. Agochtor Yugovit alangamak settlementam kanging narotinik. Biunakochivnik kanacht darvikun. Website amun IndianTrust.com amun Biu Mountain, Hwaltoklorlugu 1-800-961-6109.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.